Okay, I guess it's over to me then. So as I said, I'm Gareth, I'm from Warwick. I'm going to tell you about how we came to understand some aspects of the topology of disclination loops in liquid crystals while I was working with Randy and Penn. So this is all joint work with Randy's group, particularly with Sabetta, with Brian, who is not here. And we enjoyed a lot of discussions with Fred, who explained numerous things to us, although, of course, anything I get wrong is my fault and not his. Okay, so...
You're not the professor, Margaret. You're supposed to blame someone else. Right? So you could blame me. Anything you get wrong
I could blame
fault.
You. Okay. Anything I get wrong is Randy's fault. So liquid crystals have a sort of a long and interesting history with topology, going back, in fact, to the discovery of liquid crystals. So it turns out this is a Schlieren texture in an ematic. I think you've seen this picture several times before. It's a kind of standard one, comes, I think, from Wikipedia. So the point is that when you just look at a liquid crystalline material under cross polarizers, you see a bunch of brushes that end at points, and those points are defects. And it's this appearance, these dark lines meeting at brushes, that was the origin of the name pneumatic. Okay, so it goes right back to how people decided to call these things in the first place. They named the material after the defects in them. And that's true of a number of other materials. So for instance, this is a cholesteric liquid crystal. It's a beautiful photograph taken by Michi Nakata. So this is called an oily streak, because when you look at it under the microscope, it looks like an oily streak. And if I understand correctly, there are greasy smears and so on and so forth. And they're named because of what they look like. When I started as a graduate student, I spent a long time thinking about things like this. This is called a blue phase. It's a kind of remarkable thing. So it looks, I mean, this is a really wonderful photograph. It looks like a nice faceted monodomain crystal. Okay, look, it's just crystalline planes. But in fact, it's a three-dimensional fluid. Okay, there's no positional order in this material at all. And it has this structure and it has this cubic periodicity because it's made up of a whole bunch of defects. Okay, so it's somehow the interesting topology that's going on here that gives it this appearance. And this is an old photograph, so you get it in black and white, but it's called blue phase because if you see it in color, it's blue. All right, the length scale is optical wavelength, so it Bragg scatters. And then this last one that I'll show, these are focal conics and smectics, which we spent a long time thinking about in Randy's group, and which I could talk about more or less all day. I really came to like this structure a lot. And what's remarkable about this, I'll say just one thing. Historically, again, it's because people looked at images like this under a microscope that they understood what this material is. And in particular, just by knowing what you're looking at, what defects you're seeing in the material, you can deduce the location of the molecules with molecular resolution. Okay. Why don't you think about it, and you can ask again at the end, and I'll try.
Well, it's a photograph of material as opposed to...
Yeah, it's a liquid crystal.
Okay, that's right.
So I thought to get things going and make a couple of remarks about the interaction between liquid crystal and topology, I would go through a couple of quotes which inspire me in one way or another in the things that I do. So this is one from the late 1970s, sort of the surge of activity in understanding what's going on in liquid crystalline materials using topology started in the mid-1970s and more or less how we understand things today was sorted out by the late 70s. So here's a little quote from a nice article by Bonaro and Toulouse saying that apparently it looks as if all of the algebraic structures in homotopy theory lead to simple physical effects when interpreted in terms of defects in liquid crystals. And so in some sense, that's what I'm going to try and talk about today, how the existence of defects in liquid crystals and the processes that they can undergo are realizations of standard structures in homotopy theory. And I'll tell you what I know about it, and then hopefully some of the experts in the audience might be able to point out some things that I haven't seen yet. The other one is slightly less encouraging. This is one of my favorite quotes from Charles Frank, describing blue phases in the early 1980s. He said, well, they're totally useless, apart from one important intellectual use, which I hope everyone here can sympathize with, namely that they provide, again, tangible examples of topological oddities, and so bring topology into the public domain of science from being the private preserve of abstract mathematicians and particle theorists. And you can decide for yourself which of these latter two categories you dislike most. And
I think that whether abstract is a adjective
modifying mathematics or mathematicians. Melanie Frank, who never chose a word without choosing it carefully.
Yeah,
no,
it's careful double
entendre. Okay. So, of course, those things that I just showed you were from the late 70s or the early 80s, and a lot was done then, but then, in a certain sense, activity was slower for a few years, and mostly because it took a number of years before experimentalists could really study this in detail. There is, I believe, one very early example from Yves Boulogne's lab of non-trivial defect configurations in cholesteric. So this is, as far as I know, the first appearance in print of some non-trivial defect structure in a liquid crystalline material. And then it was, as you can see, some time later before people started seriously playing games with defects in liquid crystals. So this is from the Penn group, Philippe Boulin, Holger Stark, Tom, who's here, and Dave Witz published this very nice article of pneumatic emulsions. So this is a liquid crystalline material in a background non-liquid crystalline liquid. And it produces these remarkable sort of structures and got people really interested in how you could produce topological defects controllably in liquid crystalline systems. And as we've already heard several times, sort of the state of the art in where people have taken this is this recent science paper from the Ljubljana group, where they're able to put colloids in and move things around appropriately so as to produce a whole variety of different knots. And presumably we'll hear some exciting things about what's going on in Ljubljana from Igor tomorrow. So I want to try and tell you, I mean, it was experiments of this kind that got us interested in Penn in trying to understand how you should describe these sorts of features from a topological perspective. If you think about that quote of Punaro and Toulouse that I showed, they said that defects and the properties of defects are manifestations of standard structures in homotopy theory. So not being trained in homotopy theory, we sort of wanted to try and figure out if we could understand some aspects of homotopy theory by thinking about how they would manifest themselves in structures like this. And that's what I'm going to tell you about today. Okay, before we get there, some basics, some sort of groundwork. And it seems a little silly in some sense to be giving introductory material 3 weeks into a 4-week program. So I'll go kind of quickly over it. This is a sort of a cartoon representation of how I think about liquid crystalline materials or just ordered materials in general. And the basic framework behind which we're going to try and understand what all these interesting effects are. Okay, so first question for the audience is, if I have some sample and I put it between cross polarizers, people told you about this previously, right? So we have some polarizer in the vertical direction, some analyzer in the horizontal direction. Why is it black? Anyone?
Because you cross the polarizers.
Okay, so if you send light through some standard material between cross polarizers, it will be black. If we zoom in a little more to see what's going on, what's happening in this material, why it's black, is because there's no particular configuration to the molecules. They point in sort of arbitrary directions. Or if I ask myself, if I took this little chunk of material out and performed some transformation on it, what transformations, and then put it back in, what transformations would leave the system unchanged? And in this case, all transformations will leave the system unchanged. In other words, the symmetries of this material is the full rotational symmetry group of three space. Or it's an isotropic material, and so you put it between cross polarizers, it looks black.
This, as opposed to just very gray, I mean, it's a little bit, it's a problem.
Right, so like Randy said, you know, they work very hard to make sure that it's good, high quality black. On the other hand, this tells you immediately something interesting about a liquid crystal, where again, you have some material, you put it between cross polarizers, you would expect it to be black, but it's not. And the reason it's not is because the material is no longer isotropic. And if we zoom in on what it looks like at small length scales, we have a bunch of elongated molecules. And in my little small region of the sample, they more or less all align in some common direction. And of course, as Randy explained in some previous talk, if the orientation of the molecules is locally parallel to either the polarizer or the analyzer, then it's still dark. Okay, and that's why this particular part of the material is dark. But if I look somewhere else, they'll be oriented in some different direction, and it will be bright. And if I ask the same question, as I did over here, about what is the symmetry of this little local patch of the material, then it has the symmetry of a piece of chalk or of a right circular cylinder. So it's a D infinity symmetry. And the last sort of bit of jargon is to ask yourself, what are all of the possible orientations that I could get? So I show you two of them, but you could probe other parts of the material and ask, what local orientations could I see? And you can convince yourself that the set of possible distinct local orientations is just this quotient space, which for a cylinder is the real projective plane. And when the symmetry of the ordered material is d infinity like this, we refer to it as a uniaxial nematic. That's because you could imagine that instead the material is made out of something else, like, say, an eraser or something, right? So something with these, with this symmetry. Or I like this one. Imagine you had a big warehouse full of Avogadro's number of iPhones. What would it look like, right? So if I had Avogadro's number of iPhones, then locally they might all point in the same direction, at some other point in some slightly different direction. But if I asked what the symmetry group of an iPhone is, then it's D2 instead of D infinity. And we refer to this as a biaxial nematic. All right, so where does the topology come in? Well, if I look at one of these points where the dark lines meet, then I can ask the following question. Suppose I take any closed contour you like, I draw a nice simple one, and along that contour, I make a measurement of what the local orientation is and track how that local orientation changes as I go around this circle. So that's a fairly natural thing to do. That's a map of a circle into whatever space ground state manifold I have. This will be either RP2 if it's uniaxial, like shown, or it will be this space SO3 mod D2 if it's a bunch of iPhones. It's a biaxial map. And then what you know from homotopy theory is that such maps of a circle into some space come in different types or can be classified into different classes up to continuous deformation. Those are the homotopy groups, in this case just the fundamental group of the space. So it will be the fundamental group pi 1 of x if I am talking about base homotopy, or it will be some free homotopy set of maps S1 into X if I'm not talking about base homotopy. So this immediately introduces an interesting question. for studying defects in materials, which is, should I be thinking about based or free homotopies? So another question for the audience, which should I be thinking about? We'll ask a mathematician.
Well, I mean, as we've spent some time over the last few years discussing, there's a way to go from one to the other, so you should think about both.
Sure, but I want to classify things in an actual material.
The material is no real natural base point.
Right, exactly. So if I want to talk about the defects in the material, then I really want to be talking about freedom one. For the majority of what I'm going to do, I probably label things with based homotopy groups with pi 1, pi 2, and things like this. That's just sort of for historical reasons and for convenience. As Rob just said, we will spend some time thinking about the relationship between these.
Is this X the same as the X in the previous one?
Yes. So what I mean by X is either RP2, if it's a uniaxial pneumatic, or if it's a biaxial pneumatic, it'll be SO3 mod D2. Or in general, whatever space happens to be appropriate for the local symmetries that one material happens to have. But for the applications I have in mind, you should think RP2, except for a few small cases. Okay. So this is nice. This is the first stage in which you can introduce ideas of homotopy theory into the understanding of what you're seeing in liquid crystalline materials. If you can calculate what these groups are, or just look them up in a book, here are some examples, then you have some idea of why you see the variety of structures that you do in a liquid crystalline material. Now, Rob already said it's useful to think about the relationship between based and free homotopies. So I want to do that in the next couple of slides. So here's the first thing. It's kind of standard in the liquid crystalline community. If I go back just a second. Many of these structures that you image, like this image here, are taken in a thin cell, so that the molecules in the material more or less lie in the plane of the screen, as indicated here. If that's the case, then you would think of them not as exploring all of three space, but being sort of confined, and they would take orientations in RP1 instead of RP2, and you should expect defects of any half-integer strength. So, for instance, that's exactly what you see, right? There is half-integer strength here, and there's full strength 1 with 4 brushes at this point. But if the molecules are allowed to point in any direction in 3 space, then the appropriate X, the appropriate order parameter space, is RP2, and the fundamental group, as you said, mod 2Z. Okay, so there's a difference in the number of defects that are topologically stable depending on whether there are any constraints on what directions my molecules might point in. Nonetheless, because in many cases what you see is in a thin film where the molecules are effectively confined to 2 dimensions, a lot of the nomenclature and way of talking about things in the literature reflects that. So for instance, it would be traditional to refer to this as a -1/2 defect, and this is a +1/2 defect. But if I have a full 3-dimensional pneumatic material that can point in any direction, then I know that the fundamental group of RP2 is just Z mod 2Z, and there's only one essential map in there, which tells me these two things must be the same. Okay? So if these two things are the same, there must be some homotopy which will convert this thing into that thing. And that's my next question for the audience. Who wants to tell me what the homotopy is? Not just existence, we want to know how to do it.
State the question again.
How is the thing on the left the same as the thing on the right?
Push it. In the plane, or are you allowed to flip out?
It's in RP2. You're allowed to point in that direction.
Well, it's an L trick.
What's the belt trick? Maybe one of the liquid crystal experts should put the mathematicians out of their misery. No? Okay, so what you do is you do a rigid body rotation of every little cylinder in the plane about this axis in the plane of the board by pi. So it looks like this. Okay, sure enough, the two things are the same. Right, so that's good. At least we haven't discovered in a liquid crystal something that was supposedly forbidden from topology. Things are slightly more interesting when, instead of a uniaxial material, I ask the same question in the case or in the context of biaxial materials. So here I have two biaxial defects. This is a sort of a minus one-half type defect, and this is a plus one-half type defect. Now, the fundamental group of this funny space, this quotient space, SO3 mod D2, is the eight-element group of unit quaternions. That's something that we heard a couple of times previously. And if you're familiar with this group, then you should know that in terms of the fundamental group, these are really distinct homotopy classes. These are distinct elements. Okay? And yet, you might hope that I could do more or less the same trick as I did previously and convert one into the other. And indeed, I can. Okay, so here it is, same thing as before. So what's the difference between this case and the previous one? I mean, these are supposed to be two different homotopy classes, two different classes in pi 1. So how did I convert one into the other? Anybody? Any guesses?
You can run it backwards.
Okay, I'll run it once more, and then we're going to stare at you until you tell me what's going on. I give you a hint. The title of the slide is, you know, for a reason.
So
this is a free homotopy between these two elements as opposed to a Bayes' one. Okay, so this is the sort of difference that is important in a real material because our real materials don't have Bayes' points. All right. So what's happening here? Well, hopefully you remember from the previous slide, if you were watching closely at this point, it underwent a pi rotation like this axis, and that's not a symmetry transformation of this little brick. Okay, so it goes, this point, this Bayes point, goes around some non-trivial path on the ground state manifold in this funny space, SO3 mod D2.
So what's a free homotopy classes of SO? Some kind of...
They're just the conjugacy classes of quaternion 8.
What is it?
Well, the free set isn't a group. It doesn't have a group.
But there's five of them.
No.
Yeah. There's the identity. There's the one that involves the two pi rotation, and there's the one that involves pi rotations about each of the three distinct axes of the brick. It's just that plus and minus are no longer distinct.
The set that always has to be divisor of the group.
No. Minus one commutes with everything, but it's not in the same class as one. It's in a homotopy of order two instead of in a homotopy of order four. So whatever you're counting as must have to include that part.
Okay, so we have been interested in the fundamental group of some space because it's telling me about the presence of defects in the material. Okay? I had some defect in my material. I looked at how the order changed as I went around some closed circuit enclosing the defect. That was some loop on the ground state manifold. Some non-trivial homotopy class tells me about the presence of a defect in the material. But here I have a non-trivial homotopy class. What's happening to this Pierce point? But I don't seem to have any defect in the material. So one question that you could ask based on this observation is, where is this defect or this homotopy class? Maybe it can be realized as a defect in some material. Okay? So it's the same story. It's just free versus Bayes homotopy, but from a slightly different perspective. So I can get at that, or I can realize this relationship between free and Bayes homotopy by actually putting in a second defect in my material corresponding to this class beta that I wanted to set my Bayes point on. And I literally take my Bayes point, which is this blue dot, around the path representing the defect beta. So there it goes. So in other words, this change from some initial configuration that looks like a sort of a minus 1/2 defect, or I call minus I sigma y, to a plus defect can be viewed as dragging one defect around another. Okay, so I have these things, they're real physical objects in a material, and I grab hold of them with a laser tweezer and move them around. Okay? And the consequence of that is this relationship between free homotopy classes. So one further view of it, if I think of it not just as a two-dimensional material, but I show you how it looks sort of elongated out in time, then this motion of one defect around another starts to resemble some kind of braid. And a last sort of thing, a brief comment, which we'll come back to in a little more detail throughout the talk, is that another way of thinking about this free homotopy is to ask, how do I go from the initial class to the final class? I mean, these are elements in some group, in the fundamental group of the space, and the group has a composition law. So I can ask myself, what is the group element that takes me from this starting class to that final class?
There's a relation between numbers of conjugate classes and...
Perhaps we should leave this to the end, and then we can talk about it, if that's okay.
Sum of squares, we don't really get it yet.
Jake, when you say not rooted, so when you move this thing around, you're not fixing boundaries in infinity, or are you fixing boundaries?
Okay, so... that's a good question. That comes into how you want to do your measurement. So one of the things that you could do is you could have some fixed boundary conditions at large distances and measure with respect to that point. But then every measurement that you make would have to start and end somewhere over here. Okay. So if I want to make a local measurement just around this object, then I'm not exploiting the fact that I have some boundary condition somewhere else.
So whatever happens.
But you're right. If I have it in some cell where I know that there's some fixed point somewhere, I could just measure from there at all times, as long as I really did that.
As long as the cell is simply connected. As long as the measuring path can't get caught on something,
such as a colloidal particle,
such as a line defect.
Colloidal particles doesn't make it not simply connected.
But a line defect does.
A line, well, okay, torus.
Yeah, torus would do, for example.
Okay, so just a passing comment, because it's the first appearance of something that was in the title. The relationship between this initial class and the final class, if I ask what group element takes me between the two, you can work it out, and it's this object called a Whitehead problem.
Your X naught is a particular point you've chosen about.
Yeah, so that's just saying that that's whatever the base point happens to be.
And you chose it for purposes of example to be one of the erasers down the line of the defect.
Say for instance this point.
Yeah. Okay. So that stays fixed.
If I want to compare this initial configuration to that final one, then I should have the same choice of Bayes point when making the comparison, if I want to use this language. I mean, the other alternative is just to speak at all times in terms of free homotopy classes. Okay, so I can view this, if I want, either just in terms of free homotopy, so the action of pi 1, or, as I said, the difference between these two classes is a Whitehead product. And that's the first appearance of Whitehead products in this story. Okay. So what's interesting about liquid crystals is that they don't just have point defects in two dimensions, or they're not just two-dimensional things. They're real three-dimensional materials. And the analog of a two-dimensional point defect is a point singularity in three dimensions. And for historical reasons, they're called hedgehogs. Okay, so when people say hedgehogs, they mean some point defect in a three-dimensional liquid crystal. How do you classify them? Well, it's exactly the same story. You take some singular point in your material, you enclose it with some surface that you can measure the texture on everywhere. You can surround a point by a sphere. So I'm looking at maps from a sphere into RP2 or SO3 mod D2, whatever it happens to be. And again, I can classify the type of things that I will see in the material in terms of homotopy groups, pi 2 of RP2, for instance, if I'm thinking about base maps, or these presets if I remove the base point, which is appropriate for defects in real materials. Okay, and I'm sure you all know this. There's an integer's worth of point defects in uniaxial pneumatics, and in biaxial systems, it turns out that there are none. So one of the major questions that faces people that work in liquid crystals is to understand the relationship between based and free homotopy sets in the case of point defects in the material. And the issue really boils down to the question of what is the sign of this point defect. So we could all look at this point defect and agree that it has charge 1, but deciding whether we should think of it as being plus 1 or minus 1 is a harder issue. So for instance, here's a picture from Tom's original paper in 97 showing what looks, well, a colloidal particle with an accompanying point defect, and the colloidal particle has radial boundary conditions on it. We would say that it looks like a radial hedgehog, and the accompanying point defect has this local configuration, which is typically referred to as a hyperbolic hedgehog. And in the literature, it's common to say that the radial thing has charge plus 1 and the hyperbolic thing has charge minus 1. But is that really true? So it turns out that you can determine what the degree or what the homotopy type is by doing some integral. You just think of this instead of a map into RP2 as a map S2 to S2 and calculate the degree of the map by pulling back the area form in the standard way. Right? That's all this integral is. The thing that's interesting about it is that when you look at this integral, it has three appearances of the orientation of your molecule, N, this director field in the liquid crystal. It's odd in N, but the liquid crystal is like a piece of chalk, right? It has a symmetry under N goes to minus N. It's not a vector object, it's a line field. So apparently I should be able to replace N with minus N, and it's exactly the same texture in the material, but it changes the sign of this degree. Okay. In other words, I can choose to call this radial object plus 1 and the hyperbolic object minus 1, but I could also do it the other way around if I wanted to. And it turns out that this ambiguity is again related to the difference between based and free classes in some sense. And this time I'm not going to show you pictures, I'll just leave it as a question, which we'll come back to a little later on, of whether or not you can think of some nice homotopy that goes from this radial texture to that hyperbolic one. Okay, so that's sort of the pieces in place, as it were, that I need in order to say a little bit about how we think about, or at least how I think about, disclination loops. So I show you these pictures again as before. This is Boulogne's work. This is the recent work from the Ljubljana group. And I think if you want to keep one thing in mind throughout the rest of the talk, and one idea that for me has been kind of key in shaping my thoughts about these objects and why they're interesting is that, unlike the two previous cases that I talked about, which were point singularities, disclination loops are extended objects. They have one-dimensional extent. And the fact that they're not just point objects, but are somehow an embedded circle, is interesting and is responsible for most of the structure that they have. So here's the first thing that comes out because they have non-trivial extent. Because they themselves are a loop, I can follow along the contour length of the disclination. In addition to measuring just the presence of it with some circle that goes around and gives me some element of pi 1, I could imagine looking at some circle that follows along the contour length of the defect. And that, again, is a closed circle in the material, and so gives me another element of pi 1, or another map S1 into whatever my order parameter space is. And in general, it will measure some other element beta in pi 1. So here's the next question, and this is to see whether you remember from a few days ago what Randy told you. What's wrong with this picture if this is not the identity element? Rob.
This is a test.
Okay, so. Right. Right. So, as drawn, this had better be the identity element. If it's not the identity element, then this is the wrong picture. The right picture would be to say that I have a pair of linked loops. Okay. So it's interesting already. Just measurements of the local structure around one disclination line will tell you that there's necessarily some other structure and that it's linked with it in some interesting way. Okay, so this is sort of the canonical case that you should think of for disclination lines in ordered materials. In fact, however, it turns out that these two linked loops together naturally define a third defect in the material. So actually, just drawing two linked loops that are disjoint was also the wrong picture. In fact, the generic situation is that they should be connected together by some tether. So we have a situation in which two defects, in some sense, are collectively defining a third. So let me remind you how this works out. A nice way of seeing it is to look at this little gray torus surrounding my singular line. It has my two cycles as before, one going around the defect measuring some class alpha, one following along the contour length measuring some circle or some class beta. And I can imagine taking this little tubular neighborhood, cutting it open and laying it flat, right? It's a little torus, so I can just map it to a square on the plane with edges given by this orange circle and also by the blue circle. And then what you realize is that as a disk on the plane, or as a square on the plane, it's like a disk and it has a boundary, and the boundary of the disk is another S1. So there's actually a third circle in there which was naturally defined, on which I can measure the texture and pick up a third homotopy class or element in pi 1. Okay, so that element is just the commutator of alpha and beta, which is the Whitehead product again. So the generic situation in these with disclination loops is that you should expect them to be linked, and more than that, you should expect them to be connected together by some additional defect, and the class of that defect is given by a Whitehead product. Okay, so for instance, one example of that, which we eagerly anticipate, has been eagerly anticipated since the late 1970s, is that if you could reliably get a biaxial liquid crystal, then you could imagine that one loop is, say, sigma x, the other loop is sigma y, and there would be a tether in the class minus 1 connecting the two. Alas, no experiments to date, as far as I know.
So Frank is right so far.
Did he predict that there were no biaxial materials? There were no experiments. Oh, yeah. So we get, from this discussion, we get almost for free a very nice effect that happens in sort of the dynamics of these materials, which is to ask what happens if I take this sort of canonical situation where I have two linked loops connected by a tether and I try to pull them apart. Okay? So I imagine just, you know, some standard process where I grab with a laser tweezer one of these defects and I pull it through the other one. Well, whenever I pull it through, the blue circle on the right-hand side is now measuring the trivial class, and when it's measuring the trivial class, all of this additional structure goes away. So the appearance of this tether connecting defects is associated with crossing of disclination lines, or with linking or unlinking maneuver in this picture. This is something that was first pointed out by Punaru and Toulouse in a lovely paper in 77. So in some sense, I haven't told you anything new. It's an old story, except for one thing. So I pull up, this is the paper. This is the figure in that paper that is supposed to explain everything. And if there are any mathematicians in the room that can look at this and say, oh yeah, I know exactly what that is, I would love for you to explain it to me. Likewise, there's a very famous review article by David Merman from 1979 where he had a go at reinterpreting it. So this is his picture of how you should interpret this process. And again, I think this one's easier to understand. So that's kind of the only contribution at this point.
But there's a picture in Hatcher, which is better, right?
Maybe.
If you go back to Merman's thing.
Yeah.
So it turns out, if they had drawn it correctly, you would see that that thing in the middle is just the link in a Brahmian fashion to the other two links, right? And that's all it is. But he didn't draw it that way. He didn't know about Brahmian rings.
Where was pronouncing Brahmian? I thought it was Brahmian.
I don't know. Who is Borromeo?
Is it the count? Is it the Italian count?
Yeah. So it was the
Carlo Borromeo was the first bishop of Milano.
It was on the family crest.
Borromeo?
Borromeo.
But then how do you make the adjective out of it?
Borromeo.
Are you sure?
He Borromeo.
But we say it in English.
What's wrong with that?
M-A-N is pronounced mean in English, so it's Bor-mean.
No, it's Bor-mean. In English, it's Bor-mean.
Bor-mean. Of course, that's how you pronounce it.
Okay. So back to defect crossing. There were some experiments performed in this lovely paper some time ago looking at crossing of defect lines in coarsening experiments in liquid crystals. But as far as I can tell, there are no tethers visible under this crossing. And as far as I know, there are no experiments which show this sort of tether formation.
Do I expect a visible tether necessarily for the...
Well, if it was a biaxial material, you would expect to see something.
Yes, I know. We don't think
so in some sense, this is confirming that this is really a uniaxial material.
I mean, it doesn't look entirely like the tetrahedral structures that we see in the Ljubljana pictures either. Is that?
But it could be that the two defects are both minus one defects.
Right.
Okay.
And they could have bad luck, right? It could be that those two defects commute.
Yeah, but there's a collection of them, and all of them, and they looked at all, a lot of them.
Sure, but so it could be only the ones, but there's
possible.
No, there's a bias, because you don't know anything about the dynamics. So the bias could be that the only ones that get close enough to cross are the ones that can. All right, but that would be there'd be an energetic part to that also. That in order to have like a sigma X and a sigma Y come close to each other, you have to twist the field inside too much. But you can bring sigma x's together, right, more easily in terms of sigma y's.
You can also add the fact that the material they use is one that they generally think of to be
That's also possible.
So this means you can't use this as a diagnostic to determine whether it's uriac acidophilus.
You can only say that it's that.
If you saw it.
If you saw it, you would know it's bilateral.
We at the definitive experiment.
Exactly.
Okay, so I guess I'll throw up very quickly a couple of words on whitehead products, although I presume a lot, if not most of you, already know what they are. In some sense, this construction that I showed with linked discommutation loops connected by a tether can be thought of as a definition of them. You just need to suitably generalize it, which means instead of having two elements of pi 1 and pi 1 giving another element of pi 1, I should think of, say, pi p and pi q giving some element of some other group. So the structure is an exact sort of analogy, just with 1 and 1 replaced with p and q, as I said. And so instead of a torus, which is S1 cross S1, you can think of it as SP cross SQ. You open it up, it will bind a P plus Q disk, and the boundary again will be some sphere, a P plus Q minus 1 sphere, and the homotopy classes on these SP and SQ, which you can read, you know, S1 and S1, tells me what's happening on the boundary of this disk and gives me a class in here. And there are, you know, various constructions. So the analogous picture, this is for the case P equals Q equals 1, the analogous picture that you would draw of what this unraveled boundary looks like if you have, I don't know, Q equals 1 and P equals 2 would be something like this. These are kind of standard pictures, I hope, at least to the people that know about homotopy theory. So the other thing that's really interesting about liquid crystals, and particularly about the things that have been done recently by the Ljubljana group, is that they demonstrate a very simple fact, that there are both line and point defects in a liquid crystalline material at the same time, and they interact with each other. And that interaction should be reflected in some structure to the homotopy description of these defects, right? There should be some interaction between, say, pi 1 and pi 2, which explains what it is that you're seeing in this movie, or at least captures some aspects of what it is that you're seeing in this movie. Now, one of the first questions that you might think to ask, or at least that physicists would think to ask about this, is that if I have a point defect in the material, like a colloid that represents a hedgehog, and at large distances I have uniform boundary conditions, then I should expect that overall that charge will be compensated by some other defect in the material. And it appears that the only other defect that's present is this line defect. So somehow I have a line defect in my material, and it's representing some element not just of pi 1 of RP2, but also of pi 2 of RP2. And you can kind of see that because, you know, I could always enclose the whole thing in a big sphere and measure the texture on that big sphere and get some number and see what it is. Okay. The question is that really the right thing to do? So the question is, if I have some disclination loop like this, and I have some point charge that it's supposed to be compensating, can I assign a well-defined charge, hedgehog charge, to this disclination loop, say by enclosing it in some sphere and measuring the texture there? So, well, you might at first imagine that you could, but if you had an evil experimentalist playing tricks on you, they might do something like this on you. Okay. Which could potentially complicate matters. Okay, so let's see if we can figure out.
They would animate in the manner of Speed Racer.
That's right. Let's see if we can figure out what has happened to the disclination loop during this process. So first of all, does anybody know the answer? Anybody just see it? No?
Can I point out that the experimentalist doesn't have to be Right? The experimentalists could have just turned their head away, right? When the ball moved through the torus, right? If they're not always watching, then you lost it. You lost that information. You lost the history. Right? But they may not have been looking there.
So it's a sloppy experiment.
Yeah. Sloppy. There's limited information. You don't know how it got to the configuration it's in. Right.
You could also replace it with very clever, right? You know, they were bright enough to think to do
I
this.
I like to think
of it as
the hedgehog.
Okay. Well, you like to think of what?
The hedgehog.
Hedgehog. Okay.
The hedgehog is evil.
This is the mark.
And the ring is the fox. It's the fox. It can do lots of things, but not perfectly. The hedgehog does one thing really well.
So your configuration extends both the hedgehog and the overlord.
Right. So that's part of the problem. And we heard Brian talking about this, and we heard Yvonne talking about it last week, that it's difficult to know what direction are the molecules pointing in here, and what direction are they pointing in there. And the question that Tom would ask all the time is not just draw it for one snapshot, but draw it for all of them. Okay? And that's kind of hard. Okay? So here's my attempt at doing this. And in fact, I wasn't very successful at drawing it myself, but I had some help from Sabetta, who produced these pictures. And I'll try and run through what is happening, what our evil hedgehog is doing to our nice disclination loop. I've surrounded my disclination loop with some kind of sphere, which is measuring the charge, the pi 2 that's associated to it. And I want to see how that changes while the hedgehog moves around. Okay? So here's a sequence of images. First, it comes inside, and it links with the disclination loop. Then you push it outside again, wrap it up, and shrink this bit down so that it falls on a single curve. Okay, so does anybody recognize that? All right. Well, with enough thought about these things, you can check that the portion of the surface of the sphere, which is now somehow entangled around the point defect with this nice loop, is precisely the definition of the Whitehead product between the hedgehog charge, the element of pi 2, and whatever this element of pi 1 is representing disclination loop. Okay, so this kind of process of dragging point defects around in a liquid crystal is really an experimental realization of Whitehead products in homotopy theory. Okay, so to summarize what this has done for us, the motion of the hedgehog removes a charge given by this Whitehead product, right? That's this portion of the sphere that was dragged out by the motion of the hedgehog. So it has removed a portion of twice whatever the hedgehog charge is. So that means that whatever you thought was associated with the disclination loop has changed by 2p. And the finest grading you can put on this is if you use the generator of pi 2, you use the smallest p that's available to you, which is p equals 1. And so you can convince yourself then that disclination loops carry a hedgehog charge, but only in a z mod 2z sense, okay? Because you can change them in units of 2 in this way. Okay, so there are precisely 4 types of disclination loops. There are ones that are linked or unlinked. That was the first appearance of the Whitehead product that I told you about. And they carry either an even or an odd amount of hedgehog charge. That's the second appearance of Whitehead products. Okay, so this is a kind of a physicist's approach to the problem, emphasizing what you actually see in a material and what you can actually do with the defects in the material. But there's a slightly more traditional homotopy theoretic approach to it, which is kind of nice, and which I'll run through very briefly, just to point out one feature of it, which is that the upshot of the whole story, I think, is more or less an agreement between the two pictures. So if I look in the vicinity of a disclination loop, one of the things I said some time back that's interesting about these things is that they're not point objects, they're extended lines. And so instead of just getting one local measurement of what the texture looks like in one particular cross-section of the loop, I can ask what it is at different places, and it doesn't need to be the same at different cross-sections. It could vary as I go along the loop. And so while each particular measurement at any given cross-section is a map S1 into RP2, the collection of all of them, which represents the disclination line, is a map from a circle, that's the one that goes along the contour length, to the space of all possible textures that I could get on any cross-section, which is this funny thing I call the space of maps from a circle into RP2 with a constraint on it that I'm always measuring the non-trivial element, okay, because I have a disclination loop.
That's what minus 1 means? That's,
yeah.
That's not the inverse?
No. It's not the inverse of this operation, no. So there's a standard trick in homotopy theory which takes this kind of construction and turns it into a useful thing called a fibration, where I just look at one particular point on each of these blue measuring circles. And that restriction or that evaluation map cooks up a fibration with fiber, the pointed or the based mapping space. And once I have a fibration, I can look at the sequence associated to it. I'll run quickly through this so I have some kind of sequence. And it's a theorem of George Whitehead's in the mid-1940s that two things are interesting about this sequence. One is that pi 1 of the pointed mapping space is the same thing as pi 2 of RP2. And the second, which is perhaps more interesting, is that this homomorphism, this boundary homomorphism, is induced by the Whitehead product. So this way of thinking about things, of thinking about function spaces, and in the context of this fibration, gave Whitehead an independent way of defining the Whitehead product by precisely this one. Okay. So to end, I'd like to just say a couple of words slightly more speculatively about textures. So, textures in the context of this kind of perspective that I have described throughout the talk of thinking about non-trivial homotopy classes as being associated to the presence of defects in some ordered material. So textures are interesting things. We've seen these pictures a couple of times. This is from Ivan Shmaliuk's work on torons. So he talked in great detail about this a week ago, so I won't say much. And you saw this when Brian gave his talk. Okay, so this is an example of a nice texture in a liquid crystalline material. There are no defects, no singularities everywhere, but yet it's a topologically interesting map, say, from S3 into RP2. Which you'll hopefully recognize as being the Hopf fibration. So one of the things, if you follow this perspective that I have described by analogy in thinking of this as an interesting map, S3 to RP2, you could ask, well, in the context of materials, those always appear as measuring surfaces that surround some kind of defect in the material. So I could think of this not just as an interesting map S3 to RP2, but as some liquid crystalline texture in a four-dimensional space which has a point defect in it. You surround that point defect with a three-sphere, and whatever you see on the surface of that three-sphere is this map. And then, of course, you could imagine doing all the same games as before of moving the point defects around and getting different types of them to interact with each other to try and explore some of the free homotopies that might come up in thinking about, well, things like Hopf maps or maps S3 to RP2. And the question that I want to end with, a bit of speculation, is what if we really follow this procedure in analogy with what I said for disclinations and point defects in three-dimensional liquid crystals, where instead of thinking of a point in four dimensions, we think about some extended line-like defect. So it's the same as the difference between a point hedgehog in a 3D liquid crystal and a disclination loop. I just want to upgrade it to a loop. So this time, it's kind of hard to draw pictures in R4, so I recycle the old picture, and you have to imagine that the orange thing, instead of being an S1, is now an S2, but otherwise I get some kind of hedgehog loop in my four-dimensional space with some homotopy type P in RP2 in Pi2 going around the orange cycle, and some type alpha in Pi1. And as drawn, alpha is a trivial element, and I leave you to think about it.
So this is a based hedgehog.
Okay, so I think I said a long time ago I was going to use this based notation throughout, but I'm not necessarily restricting myself to it. It's just sort of for ease of notation.
Or consistency of notation. Free map from this to S1 process to
RP2, say.
To RP2. Then on the top, the free homotopy classes of those. How do they split? I mean, the base one split as a product, but what do they?
Well, maybe we can talk about it in detail later on. I'll give you a very quick run over without actually proving anything. Although it's relatively easy to prove it with this theorem of Whiteheads that I presented in one of the previous slides. So you do the same thing as before. You have some sort of torus now, an S1 cross S2 instead of a full S3, but you could imagine enclosing the whole thing in a 3 sphere and trying to associate some kind of Hopf charge to it, and then asking, is that really the right thing to associate to a defect of this kind? That is to say, where I was dragging hedgehogs around disclination loops previously, can I move defects in R4 around each other in interesting ways so as to get some gradation on this index? And the answer, again, is yes, I can. And again, it's associated to a Whitehead product. This time, it's associated to a Whitehead product between two elements of Pi2. So one can imagine two hedgehog loops in this four-dimensional space that move around each other in some interesting way, so that if you trace them out in time, they would form some linked two-dimensional surfaces in R5. Okay, and it's that linking of the surfaces that precisely describes this Whitehead product. So if I have an object like this, it will have a Hopf invariant, if you like, or it will carry a texture that is indexed not by any arbitrary integer, but instead by an integer only modulo 2p. So one of the long-standing questions that we have is whether or not considerations of this kind and homotopies of this kind in that you would think of in terms of defects moving around in higher dimensional spaces might be realized with the help of some kind of periodic textures in R3. Because unfortunately, we can't do experiments here. So that, I think, at least to my mind, is a still somewhat open problem that we have been talking with Fred about for some time. Okay, and with that, that's the end. So I thank you for your attention.
So can you comment on this Whitehead product if you have a biaxial medium with like a light particle in it, certainly by sigma?
Well, it depends what it is that you want to know about it. I mean, do you want to know what are all of the different possible things that one can
get? Well, whether or not it would be magical that looking at colloids in a biaxial medium be a good way of seeing whether or not it's biaxial.
It might be, but
if you've been thinking about it, suppose you start with a uniaxial system, which has a disclination ring around the loop, and you cool it down and see if it becomes biaxial. What does that become?
Well, okay, so for a biaxial system, if you want to try and detect it using defects, I think one of the best things to do is to look for these tethers that will connect linked disclination loops.
But that's not always
in the material.
You know, they made the disclination loops with their comas. So.
Sure. So if I continue and get to the punchline, I think that's probably the best test. Now, if using colloids would be a good way of stimulating that to happen, then experiments with colloidal systems would be a very good way to go. I don't know for sure whether that's the case or not yet.
The problem is anchoring, because by XCL you have to attach a discrimination line to the
source. Right. There are all sorts, but that gives an added complication, but it still doesn't rule out the possibility that working with colloidal particles might be a very good way to go. It's just, I don't know yet, right?
If you have home entropic anchoring, yeah, you still will get 2-point defects.
Yes.
In your picture of this, these two defects in white, where do you think these coming from? Regular neighborhoods or embedded circles? Do those circles have to be embedded? You can imagine having a circle cutting itself.
Yes, you could. It's hard to imagine how that would be generic.
Oh, I see.
So yes, you could imagine that, but I don't think it's a generic situation.
One of those S1s be
knotted? Sure. It turns out it's a part of Yannick's paper that the knot type doesn't affect the classification as I showed it here.
It's a link on the topic.
So at least this sort of very coarse topological description doesn't seem in uniaxial pneumatics does not seem to depend on the type of knot that you have in the system.
Are there reasonable ones that come to maps of spheres of dimension greater than 2 back into the defect? Is that also reasonable?
Not that I know of. So, I mean, you're kind of constrained to things that experimentalists can do being in some subset of R3. You can play a little bit with moving things around over time to perhaps get a factor of S1 as well, but more or less we're confined to low dimensions. That's one of the reasons why I asked in the previous slide about whether or not you could think more seriously of some of these effects coming up in periodic systems.
Thank you.